the subject matter is the larger, and we desire this afternoon to consider it from a different standpoint than it's usually considered, from a prophetic standpoint, but in another sense. Elijah's life from beginning to end is a prophecy, and that the events in his life follow in sequential order prophetically. We all know about the 1260 days, being 1260 years and so forth, but usually then we go to another topic after having understood that. But there's a great deal more involved. So this begins with the first book of Kings, chapter 17. What we'll do, instead of reading all the verses, while what we would do would cover about the same amount of time, in the way that I like to approach it is to encapsulate what is contained in certain verses. Now we start here with verses 1 to 7. Now this shows that Elijah enters abruptly into this scene. And all it tells us is that Elijah was a Tishbite and that he was from Gilead, from the other side of Jordan, one of the provinces to the north in Transjordan, that was his home base, as it were. And that's all. Now, it tells us then that he was given instruction to prophesy that there would be no dew, the EU, or rain for these years. Now, it doesn't say 3.5 years. It doesn't say 1260 days. So he didn't know until it was finished. And so James, Book of Revelation, and other places tell us how long it was. But he didn't know. But he did know one thing, that the dew and the rain would be absent for years, plural, these years. Actually, it was 3.5 years. All right, next, he was told to hide by the brook Kishon, pronounced different ways, and that this brook that he was to hide, because as a result of predicting the lack of rain, they would blame him, that he's like a curse, that ever since he begins his public ministry, he's a prophet of doom, and the doom comes. It happens. So the Lord advised him to go into seclusion to hide by this brook. And this brook is down near Jericho, not too far away, and it's a little stream that feeds into the Jordan River. And it says that it's before Jordan. Well, Jordan is a river, not a brook. And the other, we go into these details because ordinarily we read this and that's it, no more. It's gone, gone with the wind. But when you get these details, it sort of sticks in your memory better. Now he's facing the Jordan. He's before looking, so he's at a vantage point where he is. I've actually been there. Esther has too, and a couple others from the class, home class, been to the place where Elijah was. Now it tells us that God commands the ravens. Ravens, plural, not raven. All these are very significant details, that they were to feed him. And what did they feed him when you read those verses? Fish. Fish and bread. And of course he had water. The water was the brook. And that during this period that he would be there in seclusion and be fed miraculously by ravens, which are the opposite of what you would think it would feed them, because ravens are ravenous and they think of self. The ravens here would be the unconsecrated. We have an example of this during even the Holocaust in Europe, that many who were not Jews at all, some even Catholics, that they harbored and hid Jews at the risk of their life. They were not familiar with the Jew, his history, his culture, his religion and thinking, but just from a humanitarian instinct, a God-given instinct, that this was being unjust, their treatment. So this is the ravens that God commands. And then it says not only fish and bread, morning and evening. There's a regularity to this. So he's given two meals a day in this fashion. What next happens in these seven verses? The brook dries up. All right, now the brook dries up. This is a change of venue. But then, what does he do? Next verses are from verse 8 to 16. He's told, get thee to Zarephath, which is a suburb of Zidon, Z-I-D-O-N. Well, today that city exists, only spelt S-I-D-O-N, and it's in Lebanon, and it's on the Mediterranean coast. Now here he is by the River Jordan, and he's told to go way across Israel by foot, to the other coast, to the Mediterranean coast. So you don't get these when you read this. This is actually what is there. And what happens then? He's told that there would be this widow there, and that she would see to it, under God's providence, that he would be provided the necessities of life until the rain would come. And this was given privately to him, which you are not maybe expressly stated here, but certainly inferred because what he says later. All right, he goes on this long journey. He arrives there, and from the account, he must have been pretty dry himself, exhausted. And right at the gate of the city, as he's entering in, he sees this woman gathering up sticks. And she's gathering the sticks up. And then what does he say? Get me a glass of water, a container of water. Like ordering her. Now, we know why the widow was there, providentially, of course, was to prepare for her last meal with her son and herself. And under this dire circumstance, she's given a test. And what does she do? She evidently obeys. But then what happens? After she gives him the water, she starts to go away. And as she's walking away, he wants her. She says, I've only got a little flour, dry flour. And also, he wants a cake. Give me a little morsel and bring it back. Then eat. So she has to go back to her house, prepare this thing for Elijah, and then come back, and then go back to her son, and the two of them have that death meal. That's what she would be thinking. But then when he says, but I tell you, the Lord God has said, that if you do this, that you'll never want until the rain comes. That this little cruse you have with a little bit of oil, and this with the dry flour, just enough to make a little Peter, morsel for both you and your son, it won't want. That it'll be there, and it'll feed you and your house for the duration. Evidently, he had a way, Elijah, that when he spoke, that he would speak with such conviction, and so that she's impressed, and she thinks, now this is providential, and she obeys. Because she sees this as strange, but he said, thus saith the Lord, so she does it, and she's ultimately rewarded. All right, now the next thing. Get thee to Zarephath of Sidon. And then he commands that the woman there would sustain him, and he finds her at the gate. Fetch water in the vessel that I may drink. I pray thee give me this morsel of bread that I may drink bread at thy hand. And as going, he said this. But I have but a handful of meal in the jar and a little oil in the cruse. Have not a cake. She hasn't even prepared the flour to eat it. So she's gathering these sticks to dress it for her and her son to eat and then die. And then he says, fear not, because this is what's going to happen. The Lord's going to bless you if you do this. All right, now what happens? Verses 17 to 24. What happens in this interim, as he's there for many days, lo and behold, the son dies. She then is very upset. She says, have you come here to bring a curse? She had been blessed here for a long time with the other, and she says, have you brought the sin to mind? It suggests that the son is an illegitimate son. Have you brought my sin to mind? I don't know the exact verse, but this is in the content. And then he, of course, resuscitates the child. And she's very happy that now she has her son back, and this then gives her the further conviction that he indeed is a prophet. And it impressed or scored this on her memory good for the rest of her life. That would be him there. All right, now the next thing. That's verses 17 to 24. Art thou come to call my sin to remembrance and to slay my son? And then he stretched himself, and it mentions three times upon the child, and it revives. By this I know that thou art indeed a man of God. Now, 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. Now, we've finished one chapter, so we're covering a lot of ground. The next chapter tells us, 1 Kings 18, that in the third year, the famine has not ended. It's still sore distress in Israel. But in the third year, go show thyself to Ahab. And the famine, it mentions, as being sore in Samaria. And then this incident occurs about Obadiah, who he meets, and he wants Obadiah to make this contact. And Obadiah confesses that how he hid prophets of the Lord in a cave, 100 of them, 50 in one cave, 50 in another cave, at the risk of his life, knowing how, of course, Ahab and Jezebel felt about the true prophets of the Lord. And what happens then? It mentions that he meets Obadiah, go tell thy Lord, that is, that Elijah is here, the one who is this prophet of doom. But it shall come to pass, now he says, this is Obadiah. Now this is very interesting. Obadiah says, but if I do that and I go to Ahab and I come back, he'll probably be gone, because it says he had a record that doesn't tell us that he was previously translated, taken up from different places. See, he says, as soon as I'm gone, the Spirit shall carry thee whither I know not. Has it not been told thee, you know, about Ahab, what he feels? And then if he tells Ahab he's here, and then he's not there, what's going to happen to Obadiah? He says, my head is in the noose. And it shows that there are parts of his life that are not recorded at all, but that there was this experience. There's something else that happens a little later that gives us an insight about Elijah that it doesn't expressly go into any detail. First thing, verses 17 to 20. Art thou he that troubleth all Israel? This would be, I think, the comment of Ahab to Elijah, and he says, I'm not the troublemaker, you're the troublemaker, because of what your attitude, your responsibility as a king to administer my judgments and commandments to my people Israel. You've forsaken that responsibility, you've incurred this responsibility, so the fault lays with you, Ahab, not with me. I'm just the instrument or channel of pronouncing what God has to say, as it were. Then what happens? What does happen that he advises Ahab, and it makes sense to Ahab, gather all Israel, that is 450 of your prophets, gather them together, your own prophets, gather them together, and of Baal, and the 400 prophets of the groves. The 400 prophets of the groves were Jezebel's prophets. So Jezebel had 400. Ahab had 450 that were more tied in with the government aspect. And there was to be this contest. Get all your prophets and ask your God, and I'll come just alone, Elijah, and I'll ask my God for rain. That's the purpose of this gathering, to get some leavens, to be rescued from this circumstance. All right. So what happens? Elijah says, and of course he hadn't, says, get me two bullocks. And one of these bullocks, the prophets would bring them, and he's putting everything in their hands to show this is neutral, that there's no finagling on his part. Have them bring two bullocks, but one I'll take, and one will be representative of them. And then we'll address these animals, prepare them for sacrifice. And they build an altar, and then Elijah, he would build his altar. One that had previously been broken down, he would reassemble it. And what happened? We know that the contest then began early in the day, a little after dawn, and they cried to Baal for an answer. This would be a contest between who is God, Baal or Jehovah, that the God that answereth by fire, let him be the God. Well, that seemed to be a fair contest, even though there were so many on the other side. And Ahab saw to it, the stage was all set, and it said they cried, and they even cut themselves, and they were so taken in with desperation for that fire to come down, they even climbed up on the altar, showing it's like whirling dervishes, out of control, getting in the spirit, their spirit. But no answer. This goes to noontime from the context. So then comes Elijah's turn. But then what he does, he dressed the animal himself. He must have been a strong man. Don't forget, these are bullocks. He cut it in pieces and skinned it, flayed it, all that. Oh, that's a lot. And he assembled the altar. That's a lot of work with stones. And now he has a sacrifice on the altar. And it's on wood that he prepared. Now, that took a little time there. Then he, instead of starting to their surprise, the ones looking at this, he wanted water, barrels of water to be brought. And he poured it on the altar, on the bullock, on the wood, on the altar. And he did this, I think, about three times, just drenched it. And it tells that the trench that he dug around the altar, that at a measure, I won't go into that detail, but it would fill up. And so here you have a thoroughly drenched sacrifice, no secret sparks. And then he offers a simple prayer, a short prayer. And lo and behold, the fire comes down. And what does that fire do? It doesn't only consume the bullock, the wood, and the stones. The stones were consumed, not heated, they were consumed, and all the water that was drenched there just went up, almost like a mini atomic bomb, and it just disintegrated the whole arrangement. Well, the Lord, he's God, they couldn't deny this, and that he proved that he had nothing to do with any subterfuge of hocus pocus, as it were, and to make it illusion, that this came down and they could all see. But then what does Ahab do? He goes back and tells his wife, Jezebel. And tells Jezebel, you can be sure all the details. But is she converted? Oh no, he says, before the sun goes down, you know, the next day, this is before the sun of this next day goes down, Elijah, he's going to be no more. You know? And of course Elijah gets wind of this and he prepares to flee from Jezebel. All right, now, we go back. The prediction, we find the famine actually lasted 3.5 years. 1,260 days. James tells us that. And the book of Revelation has this. And we find that this experience of Elijah is tied in with God's methodology. For instance, in one chapter of Revelation, it says that the holy city would be tread underfoot for 42 months. In another place, it mentions that the word of God would be dead 3.5 days. It mentions that in the account of another chapter. Another chapter says that the woman who was standing on the moon and the sun is robing her with glorious light, and she has a diadem of stars. This is the church, the early church, in its glory and purity, as it were. But an anomaly, she's pregnant, this woman, and she brings forth a man-child. And the man-child is caught up, and he's styled as Michael, and his angels fighting the civil government. And what happens? The religious government prevails. And so you have the 1260 days as representing 1260 years. Almost all Bible students know from 539 to 1799 is that period of time. But what is not usually thought of is that there are events that take place in that time slot of the 1260 years. So after 539 A.D., things happened that would indicate there was a famine, spiritually speaking. One period of the church, I'll just read some of them. For instance, we know that the gospel age is likened to 7 time periods. Remember the messengers to the church? That down through the age, the Lord raised up prominent individuals who ministered a gospel witness work. And that is divided in 7 periods. All right. Then what happens? We find that in one of these accounts, the message to the churches, it mentions about Jezebel. Well, see, Jezebel was back there with Elijah. And then, instead of Elijah being mentioned in Revelation, we see a woman goes into the wilderness where she's nourished for 1,260 years. Well, that woman represents the Elijah class. It's interesting, instead of saying Elijah, it says a woman, because she's absent from her Lord, the head. And Brother Russell, in that very chapter, Elias Shall Come, says that when Elijah is considered as a male, it represents Jesus with his church, and when the head is not recognized as a male, as being absent, she's a woman. The male becomes a woman. The ecclesiastical aspect. The papacy is the male aspect of the false Christ. All right, now in that period, it tells us that there would be a time during Jezebel, one of the periods of the church, that there would be this sacrificing unto idols. It makes you think of the Baal worship, etc. And then in one period, it says you have a reputation that you live, but in reality, you're dead. But it's these others that bring it in very more vividly. 7 periods of the church as messengers. There are 7 trumpets, 7 seals, and these are related to the 7 periods, but from a different perspective, viewed as it were in one case, exactly the same time period, another just a little difference, but basically the same, viewed from the perspective of a seal, of a trumpet, from a message standpoint. What does it say with regard to the seal? In this 1260-year time period, it tells us that there are horses that come forth. Remember the white horse, the red horse, the black horse, the pale horse. It's the black horse and the pale horse shows that it's a period of famine and death. Death from famine, starvation, as well as sword. Elijah fled for fear of the sword, being slain. So now what happens in the seal thing is that the black horse had its rider, and he had a pair of scales in his hand, and at that time, when if you were to buy food in the market for a day's wage, a penny, that you could get 3 measures of barley, but only 1 measure of wheat for the same price. So if people who have a family will get the barley for prudence sake, because they have too many mouths to feed. And so it showed the strategy of the church to have a little goodness, as it were, in the message, but very, very little. And they were fed on harlot's food. Barley was the test. Remember, if a woman was suspected of being unfaithful to her husband, she was given this dust from the tabernacle floor, and it was put in water, and she was made to drink. If she was innocent, said nothing would happen, and she'd be exonerated. But if she was guilty, it would turn into worms and would result in her death in a horrible manner, a very conspicuous manner. So barley became to be known as the harlot's food, see, like Jezebel's food. And the truth itself, as far as the public mark was concerned, was very scarce to find. But regardless of that, at the same time that there was this offering of food in the market, it says that God made a commandment that during that period, that one thing, it says, thou shalt see that thou dost not hurt the oil or the wine. And this is addressed to the true people of God, that in spite of the famine of the Dark Ages, that the little food that they had, that it would miraculously sustain them, and that even they'd have the joy of the truth. In spite of that circumstance, the holy anointing oil would give them the strength, the power, and the wine would make them exuberant, in spite of that thing. So that had to do with the seal. In another case, it had to do with the trumpets. In the third trumpet and in the fifth trumpet, in the third trumpet, it said that one-third the part of the world of the people died because of the bitter water. Then in the fifth seal, it says that it was commanded. There was locusts, a tremendous locust plague in the fifth trumpet, and it was commanded, these locusts, thou shalt not hurt the grass of the earth. The grass of the earth are the humble, the one that have life, the ones that have truth. They're pictured as little blades of grass. Thou shalt not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their forehead. So one class suffered as a result of the famine and the death and the things that happened. The other class are preserved during that period. So you can see there's a co-relationship back there with Elijah, his literal experiences, with the symbolic experiences that would happen to the church down through the age. One more. There's about the dragon. Now, remember it says there were two wonders in heaven, and it says you see this great dragon, this fierce big dragon in the heavens, and then another sign, this woman who was just beautiful, the sun on her, and a royal diadem of 12 stars, and the moon under her feet, the law, the pure law, the light of the moon. But strange, she's in labor, and she gives birth to a child. Now, it says that that woman who was so robed, she fled into the wilderness where she was nourished for 1,260 days. Now that woman, that same woman, is recognized as the true church in spite of the man-child which came from her. Now this, I think, is worthy of a little consideration. It says that in the early church that the mystery of iniquity, this seed, this bad seed, in another parable of the wheat and tares, the devil came, and he sowed foreign seed. So God repeats over this picture, this picture, this picture, this. And if we can't see it then, we're pretty dunce. He's done everything he can to show us and convince us that this is his word. That's the bottom line. All right, now then what happens with regard to all of this? It shows that the implantation of the seed does not harm the nature of the woman. In other words, a woman who's raped and has been a virgin, oh, she mourns, and oh, she feels that, oh, that her chances of the future are nil, especially if you're a Muslim. If you're a Muslim, and it was that's a death sentence right away. Now, what happens? This is a proof that when it's put into a petri dish or what, and developed and then planted in the woman's womb, being she did not have familiarity with man, that there is no condemnation in that in principle. The same thing God planted in the Virgin Mary's womb, a seed of life, Jesus, into her womb. Now, she still was a virgin, in spite of this seed being implanted in her womb. There was no sexuality involved. There's no guilt involved. Well, with the Virgin Mary, we can certainly see that, because it says that about her, how different she was from other women. But this is also true with regard to this woman in the heaven who represented the early virgin church, is found to be pregnant by an evil seed in the belly, as it were. It happened that the devil planted that seed in her. But she's not responsible. Whether it's for good or for evil, she's not responsible in herself. So we can see that you can have a virgin church run into the wilderness, the woman, where she was nourished by God. And you can see the false Messiah that came out, that there is a difference with regard to that. That the guilt aspect is quite different than going out in the world with ones of your own kind and having this familiarity. So we got off on the sidetrack there. All right, now the next thing. Going back to verse 41 to 46 of chapter, what is it? This is 18 of 1 Kings. He, that is Elijah, said to Ahab, "Get thee up, eat and drink, because there's a sound of rain, a noise of rain." Well, what is the noise of rain? Thunder. Thunder in the distance. Way in the distance. Thunder. And which would signify impending rain. It isn't over yet, but he's told that now they have this contest and all, and he has to not go back to Jezreel, back to his home base, and stay there. And what happens? He goes. Now, in the meantime, Elijah goes to the top of Carmel. Carmel is on the Mediterranean Sea, that far side, Mount Carmel. That's north of, let's say, Tel Aviv, on that side. He's still on the west coast of Israel. He came from, remember, way over by the River Jordan. So he's still over in this area. And what does he do? It mentions here, he goes up himself, but nothing happens. He casts himself down on the ground, and he puts his face between his knees. But he says to his servant what the servant should do. Now you go up, and you look toward the sea. He went up, and he says, there's nothing. And then he tells him, you go up seven times, including the first one, and then six more. In other words, something like Naaman the leper, where he was told to go to wash himself in the muddy River Jordan. So he says, go again seven times, and then he saw something, and he tells Elijah that there ariseth a little cloud out of the sea, like a man's hand. Man's hand. So he's looking out over the sea. He's on Mount Carmel, and he's looking out over the Mediterranean Sea, and he sees in the distance, arising out of the water, a hand, the palm of a hand, this part, the cup of a hand. Then he tells Elijah about that. Ah, now with Elijah, that is very meaningful. It's not just a sound. Now you have a hand arising up out of the sea, out of water. You know, it's like Moses, when he crossed the Red Sea, he raised his hand up, let alone with what it was in it. But that raising up of the hand was now imminent, and the waters parted. Well, so there's a history here, that Elijah would be familiar with. That was a very favorable, even though it was like a cloud, like a hand. And then what happens? He knows it's going to come very soon. So he tells Ahab, in this whole context, you better get back before a washout. And so Ahab gets in his chariot and he races home. And what happens? Elijah races in front of him and runs faster than Ahab and his chariot. So you can see that Elijah had quite a reputation. Not only what Obadiah say, if I go and come back, who knows, you may be taken up. Goodness knows where. You're gone. And here's another example where he had this fleetness of foot under the Spirit. Like David, he could tear apart the lion's jaws with the power of God's Spirit when it is operative. So we find that eventually the heaven was black with clouds and there was a great wind and a great rain. And then Ahab goes to Jezebel and he tells how the Lord dealt with Elijah. And in this telling of Jezebel, then she pronounced, as it were, a death sentence on Elijah. We're now in Kings 19th chapter. There was the 17th chapter, the 18th chapter, and now it's the 19th chapter. Verses 1 to 3, it says that he goes to Beersheba, then one day's journey further. All right, first thing, we would go back. Because I have no written script. I have some notes here just to remind me of the wording. But that little cloud corresponds to the French Revolution, the contest that Elijah had, where the two altars were there and all. That refers to the Reformation. Say, first there was this woman, her child resuscitated, her cruise, and so forth. That's one stage. Next stage is Luther's day, 1517, etc. A little later, there was this contest, and Luther, one man, stood up before the emperor of Germany that was called, and all the ecclesiastics, and he trusted in God, and this one man, they wanted him to recant on the point of death. But the Lord says, I've opened this door of opportunity to you, and no man can close it. When I close a door, that's it's closed. If I open the door, it's open. And that was manifested in the Reformation, and you had the birth of the Reformation, a change, a miraculous change, because of the bondage that existed before. So then comes the French Revolution, is that cloud of rain, that potential. Now, as a result of the French Revolution, you had the Bible societies, the rain. So what we're just trying to show, the relationship of Elijah's experiences with that of history as it occurred down through the Gospel Age, that there is a mathematical, definite relationship between the two. We cannot see it in all its glory, and that, but you can sense that this is happening, that this happened. So now he flees, and this fleeing started to take place as a result of what happened at the French Revolution. The false church, when they saw this defeat, because when did the beast die? You see, it's in late years. There was a time where the papacy, the beast was not. It was not, and yet it's revived. Well, in the time of the French Revolution, the temporal power of papacy was shamed for a little period of time. And the Pope, as a result, had to go into a reclusion for 70 years. And then in 1878, he comes out and his declaration of infallibility, which is a very strange thing, especially when you read what happened. Bishop Schlossmeyer's account of what occurred the very day he made that is really, you laugh at the thing with all the power and what was happening. The house is almost coming down. They're in the darkness and all the things that happened. He records it in detail. He was there the very day that happened. Now here, what happens is the counter-reformation. America was founded by colonists who wanted to get away from that bondage and persecution that existed in Europe. This is like Elijah's flight, not to America. He went in another direction. But the principle that in spite of this great reformation that took place as a result of uncovering what had happened in the dungeons in France and so forth. And, all right, now he flees for his life. Now it says he goes one day's journey from Beersheba. Beersheba is the last town that was inhabited. And if you go one day's journey further south, well, you're really in the wilderness, as it were. You're separated from it. Now that journey from where he was originally, it started on the west coast of Israel, as it were, and down. He goes down to this last town and then a little further. What's he do when he's there to one day's journey? He sits under a tree, and the tree is called a juniper tree.
That's interesting. It's in this revised version, it calls it a broom tree.
That's right. It's called the broom tree. Uh-huh. And this represents the date 1846, where we know that in the end of 2300 days of Daniel, that this was this separation of the host and the sanctuary class. And that's where this establishing a cult started. But it more materialized with the Federation of All Churches, where England participated 100 years later, as it were, from that date. But the baby, the birth, was back there in 1846. That is the broom tree, the sweeping clean, the separation of the host from a sanctuary class. It started with the Millerite movement, but when he, in 1829, when he started his ministry, it took time to blossom, and it eventuated in the truth movement. Actually, what happened? It was a precursor. There was a disappointment, and then lo and behold, we have what we call present harvest truth that developed. This is this flight that existed. Now, he went to sleep. Now, I cannot go into all the details because I'm trying to cover goodness knows how much material, but now the next thing we notice is that he had two sleeps. This under the broom tree, there were two sleeps. So the second sleep carries you forward more. The first sleep was 1846, where he initially was under the broom tree. But then he ate and slept. The Millerite movement, he ate and slept. And then what happened, there was this second eating and sleeping that took place, and that refers to what we call the present truth movement, which led us up to Sinai. For instance, 1874 plus 40 is 1914. If you make it 1878, it's 40 years, it's 1998, bringing us up to a condition that existed where it was to meet God. There he would be blessed. There was a prophecy along this line, which we haven't time to go in, that was uttered, that would occur. Now what happened? It was the brotherhood, the consecrated, did think that the church would be gone in 1914. Later that was changed to 1918. Later that was changed again to, that we'd have to go to Matthew 24th chapter and 25th chapter to go into that subject. But what happened? The end did not come at that time, but the church is still here. So what we have is a prophecy that covers from 539 up to the First World War. But now, once he leaves Sinai, then events are described that have subsequently occurred since the First World War. That events that have happened. And I don't know if I have time for that at all now. But what happened? He's now at Sinai. He's in the cave. Eventually, he gets a vision. And in that vision, there are four stages. There's the wind, earthquake, fire, and the still small voice. And what happened when 1914 came and nothing occurred of what was really anticipated? Brother Russell died in between the two dates, 1914, 1918, 1916, he died right in between. There was an expectation in 1918. And this is one of the travels from Mount Sinai is covered by that. He went to Gilgal, he went to Bethel, he went to Jericho, he went to Jordan. Four different trips. These represent four experiences since the First World War that have occurred. And there's still some future. And that part, God willing, we would like to discuss at the next meeting. What those dates were, what happened, and why we're still here. It hasn't yet, we believe, the door is still open. So we have maybe three or four different pictures that give us some indication roughly where we are on the stream of time from what we previously were expected to occur in 1914. And look how many years. We're in, what, 2000 something, right? 2002 and 1914? I mean, that's 86 years to just the year 2000. 86 years. We're over 90 years, as it were, and still, the door is still open. This, we believe, is a gleaning work. A gleaning work is a part of the harvest. Even though it's a paucity, it's a part. And now we see that they're not coming in numbers like they did in Pastor Russell's day. And the millions of volumes that were sold far outdo the message that's done today. In spite of the wonderful things, tools that are available today, the message is not making that impression. Don't forget, those volumes were sold. They were not given away. Brother Russell gave instructions. He even gave personal advice, if necessary, something, if not the real price, that not to give them free. So many of us try to, oh, we so want them to have the truth. But there's that principle that the other party has to act in getting.
I just read something recently on that. Some brother said, what should he do? And he let him have it for a certain amount, but a small, maybe a nickel or a dime.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he had to pay.
Yeah. So we're now up to, let's say, the First World War. Now we'd like to, God willing, the next study, finish this study to show about the experiences, because Elijah wasn't changed until much later, when he was taken up into heaven. And he went where he got the companion, Elisha, and then he had other events occur, different places he went. And not only did he come to the River Jordan, he crossed Jordan. He's still alive. He crossed Jordan. He went on the other side. It doesn't tell us the exact period of time. And then he was translated. Well, we're in that in-between time. And it hasn't happened, the final members of the church. There'll be no individual who will be the last member. It'll be a group of individuals, because it would take away from the head. Because you'd automatically say, well, Jesus Christ is the head, and brother or sister so-and-so is the last. No, it's going to be a group. And that's why it shows it as a translation of a group, not an individual. Elijah does not represent an individual. Elijah represents a class, a group, a number. And that translation then, there will be no single individual to say, in the future he's the last. That would be distracting from the head. Because you'd feel, well, you know, we're mathematical. We'd like to know who's first and who is last. No, it's just a small group.
Do we have any proof for that statement?
Well, yes, there are other proofs, but not now. We're beyond,
we're on
I don't see the clock, but we're after the... It's just right time. And God willing, the next time, we'll try to again go from Mount Sinai to the translation.
That would begin with 19 or 20 of our death.
We went into 19, but we want to go a little further because you notice it's the second book of Kings that tells us a little tiny bit more.
Oh. Mm-hmm. For instance, the second half of 19.
No, but there's the translation of...
We only went to Kings, 1 Kings 19 and 11 and 12, where we ended up with.
Yep. Yes, we went to Mount Horeb, the Mount of God, and that he lodged in Sinai in the cave. Of course, that goes into verse 9, like you're saying, a little tiny bit further, but not much more. We didn't go into the other things about him being jealous for the Lord, but we did mention about the wind, the earthquake, and the fire, and still small voice. But we haven't explained that, so that's where, God willing, the next time we'll speak on those incidents, what they represent.